Rebecca, you have written an ingenious book about Plato, but it seems the real subject of your book is why philosophy still matters. Why did you feel the need to make this argument?
I suppose I get into conversations about this quite often, and the people I'm speaking to whom I have to make this argument, are usually coming from two different sides, not at the same time. One is from the science side. There's often the argument made that philosophy is obsolete. The terminus of this process that's been going on ever since Plato is for philosophy to disappear. And for the most part, it really ought to already. They're just annoyances. They're just like what Socrates had described himself as a gadfly. They're just annoying the people who are doing the important work, science. So there's that coming from one side. And then from the other side is a debate I often have with religious people, where it's felt that, look, as far as all questions about values, about how we ought to live our life, about morality and ethics, religion takes the place of that, that human reason is too flimsy and paltry a means of arriving at these answers, and we need the word of God. So philosophy, I think, gets squeezed in between both of these points of view, the scientific and the religious.
I want to follow up on particularly the critique that we hear from some scientists. And
yes.
I mean, a lot of famous scientists have recently been saying that philosophy is no longer relevant. Stephen Hawking said philosophy is now dead. It's been replaced by physics. And
yes.
Another physicist, Lawrence Krauss, has also dismissed philosophy. He says that, science keeps advancing and making new discoveries. Philosophy simply seems to rehash the same old arguments it's been having for centuries. Essentially, he sees philosophers as failed scientists.
Exactly. Yeah, and even more recently, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is the new moderator of the New Cosmos,
right,
taking Carl Sagan's place, and Carl Sagan had a very healthy respect for philosophy, has also claimed that, you know, philosophy just messes with your mind, you know. Get on with it, young people.
Right. I mean, if you want to actually ask questions about the real world, go to science. Forget about all that sort of dorm-style philosophizing late at night.
Exactly. I think there are some grounds for this claim. And if you look at the history of science, you see that it often begins with philosophers, right? That the first so-called physicists and cosmologists, which is back in the ancient Greek world, they were philosophers. And they're asking the questions that eventually physicists and cosmologists would be able to answer. What is, you know, this stuff that we see all around us? Can we break it down into something more simple? All sorts of things were theorized, including by Democritus, something called an atom, you know, from the Greek word atom, indivisible. So that first concept came from a philosopher, but just speculating about it, not using the empirical methodology, which doesn't really emerge in its full glory until the 16th, 17th century, really the 17th century with Galileo and then Sir Isaac Newton. And then even more recently, linguistics, artificial intelligence, logic itself, these all belong to the domain of philosophy. And then much more rigorous and testable methodologies emerge. And so there's some grounds for scientists saying, look, philosophers, yeah, they're important until the scientists arrive on the scene. You know, they keep down the fort until the cavalry arrive. You know, there is some justification for this claim that philosophy is always a sign of premature, immature science.
Are you saying philosophers tend to ask different questions than scientists do?
Philosophers should not be in the business of describing physical reality. We have science for that. Philosophers don't have to worry about that descriptive or even ontological enterprise anymore. But what they do have to worry about are the things that scientists are telling us and the enterprise of trying to reconcile that with a larger picture. So, for example, to try to make it more concrete, we now have not just physics and cosmology treading where philosophers used to tread, but much more importantly or much more relevant because it's a new development, the brain sciences, neuroscience, evolutionary psychology, cognitive science, talking about things that used to belong entirely to the domain of philosophy, the nature of consciousness, perhaps free will, perhaps moral responsibility.
Well, I want to come back to one of the other criticisms that's leveled against philosophy, that philosophy never makes progress.
Yes.
Is that true?
No.
How does philosophy progress?
And this was, in fact, one of my major reasons for bringing Plato back into our day in Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Doesn't Go Away, because I wanted to show Plato how much progress we had made. And here, one of the places, I think, in which we can really find progress made by philosophy is in the realm of morality. If you look at many of, perhaps even all, of our revolutions in progress, in moral progress, they start with arguments. And they're arguments that are, again, trying to maximize our coherence. They're saying, look, we're already committed to this. In fact, I can't live without the commitment to, say, my own life mattering and those whom I love, their lives mattering. Does this commit me to anything further, logically? And philosophers have argued, taking commitments we already have, showing that they're inconsistent with attitudes and practices that are almost universal, say slavery, for example, and making the argument for it, that's only half the battle, because then, you know, it has to invoke or ignite emotions, because nobody makes these changes without emotions. People have to start empathizing. But the first spark often comes from arguments, from mm-hmm. pure abstract arguments.
Well, and it's striking how our notions of rights, of who deserves rights, has expanded so dramatically in the last few centuries.
Yes.
I mean, you know,
yes.
slaves, the impoverished, the colonized, women, children, gays,
the
handicapped, even animals. I mean,
that's right.
They
yes.
all have rights now in a way that they never used to.
Right, exactly. And it all starts with arguments. And it's always, you know, we don't like to change our minds about these those whose interests are hurt by changing their mind about these things, by these expansion of rights, of recognizing the rights of previously marginalized groups. There's a tremendous inertia, tremendous resistance, and but it usually starts with an argument that demonstrates an inconsistency. This is the real crux of how philosophy proceeds. You know, trying to maximize our coherence. And so, look, if we're already committed to this, we've got to take it farther. And it's interesting that often an argument that's already been accepted will then be co-opted by another group and said, well, if you've already accepted this argument, you're going to have to apply it to this other group. So when slavery, the argument against slavery, finally came to be accepted, people like Marianne Sell said, oh, and by the way, the same argument applies to women. And this was, you know, in the 17th century. So it takes a really long time. Nobody wants to change their mind about these things if it's in their self-interest not to. But fortunately, we do not like the feeling of being inconsistent.
Yeah. I want to come back to really the focus of your book, Plato, arguably the most important figure in the history of philosophy. Why does Plato fascinate you?
Why does Plato fascinate? Yes, I've been fascinated by Plato for a really long time, which is not to say that I think he got everything right. But what fascinates me about Plato is that he carved out the landscape of philosophy. Philosophy consists of so many subgenres, you know, philosophy of math and philosophy of art and philosophy of language and philosophy of history and philosophy of science and philosophy of knowledge itself. And Plato, in some sense, asked all the fundamental questions of these various areas. He kind of lifted the whole continent of philosophy up single-handedly. And that's kind of amazing that this one man did it. And I'm also interested in the fact that he was an ancient Greek. Philosophy was in the air. So I very much wanted to see Plato in the context of the ancient Greeks. They're amazing. They were the super overachievers of all times. And why did they do this? And why did they approach these questions of how we ought to live and what can we do to make our lives matter? Why did they approach this question secularly and not religiously? At the same time that they were asking these questions, the major religions were emerging, the ones that still exist today. You know, we call this the Axial Age. Hmm. Confucius, Buddha, the Buddha, Pythagoras, and the prophet Ezekiel were all contemporaries of each other. That's kind of amazing.
So why did these ancient Greek philosophers approach this rationally without religion?
I think it's a really very complicated question that I do try to get into in the book. Before the philosophers arrived on the scene, before, you know, Socrates, you know, wandered around the marketplace and then Plato took over and Aristotle, the Greeks had already non-philosophically been approaching this question of what do I do to achieve a life of mattering, which is, I think, the fundamental question of the Axial Age. It's what kind of forced this normative format and these great normative paradigms to emerge. But that question, that basic existential question, what do I matter? Is there something I have to be or do in order to matter, emerged. And they answered that question not in terms of their gods. They were a very religious society. Their culture was drenched with religious rituals. But when it came to this most fundamental question of achieving mattering, they didn't look to their gods. They didn't look to the attention of their gods. So it was the last thing they wanted. Something always terrible happens if the gods pay too much attention. They looked to each other. They wanted to do something big and magnificent. Oh, the Greek word for it is kleos, you know, a kind of glory. And then the fame that you win from that glory, so that they would be their name would be on everybody's lips. And that way they would achieve a moreness to their life. And even hopefully their names would live on after their deaths.
Did Plato go along with that thinking? That, I mean, what made a life worth living was the fame, the reputation that you would have after death?
He very much rejected it. He vehemently rejected it. But the thing that he did accept and that makes him a Greek, and that we, who have gone much farther from him, might want to question, I certainly won't want to question, is that only the extraordinary life really matters. There is ordinary life doesn't matter. I don't think that we believe that anymore, but I don't think that our full understanding of that really emerged until the Enlightenment. For Plato, what he did accept from his Greek milieu, and this is what makes him a Greek, is that, yes, you have to do something very, very big and extraordinary, but not all kind of extraordinary matters. The unexamined life is not worth living. When he has Socrates say that in Plato's rendition of Socrates' trial, he's both agreeing with his fellow Athenians that most lives are not worth living, but he's rejecting their view of what the kind of extraordinary you have to have. For him, really, the philosophical life, the life of reason, the examined life, which of course requires great resources, requires education and luxury to think and a great deal of intelligence. That's the only life that matters. So I think, you know, it's at once an extraordinarily elitist statement, and it's an agreement with his culture, but also a radical disagreement enough so that if Socrates really did say something like that at his during his trial, that might have had a lot to do with why he was sentenced to death. And of course, he was sentenced to death. He was not in agreement with his culture. He was partly, but partly not.
Let me follow up on the execution of Socrates, certainly one of the pivotal events in the life of Plato. Now, it's worth pointing out that Socrates was Plato's teacher. Socrates was, what, 70 when he died, and Plato was in his late 20s then. What lessons does Plato draw from the death of Socrates?
It truly moves him. He draws philosophical, political conclusions, but he also, I think it had a huge emotional effect on him. But the first thing, you know, he did was he left Athens and he traveled widely for about 10 years. I mean, he may have felt that he was in danger, or he may have just been disgusted with his own culture. And Plato tells us that he was planning to go into politics until the death of Socrates, and that's when he decided to turn to philosophy, that there can be no good politics in the city if we don't have people studying, you know, the nature of virtue and the nature of knowledge and the nature of justice.
So it sounds like one of the lessons that Plato took away from the execution of Socrates was, maybe you really can't trust the people who are making these kinds of legal decisions. You can't trust the state in some way. They're not always very wise.
Yeah. You know, he was a tremendous critic of the democracy of his own city-state, of Athens. I mean, you know, we owe Athens so much, philosophy and science, but we also owe that city the first experiment with democracy. And it was not a representative form of democracy. Every citizen, which meant about one out of three residents, because there were, of course, slaves and there were, of course, women, and they were not citizens, but every citizen could vote on just everything, you know, whether to go to war and who to send as the general and how many boats to send and whom to exile. Everything was voted democratically. And Plato did not have much faith in the reasoning powers of his fellow citizens. He thought reasoning is very difficult, as indeed it is, but he didn't want to put these decisions in the hands of the people.
Hmm. Now, the question that you keep coming back to in your book is essentially, what would Plato do in today's world? You know, does he still have wisdom to offer, you know, if he were transported 2,500 years into the future? And let's play that out a little bit. Education. I mean, it's a hot button issue these days. I mean, what's the purpose of education? And we know that a lot of the debates about schooling these days have to do with sort of making it more pragmatic, making sure that students, by the time they graduate, will come away with some job skills, for instance, that will serve mm-hmm. them well in future life. What would Plato say about this?
Yeah. Well, you know, he was the Plato from back then, you know, divided people up in terms of their innate capacities. And so he would probably be all for kind of tracking. So, you know, this place in which I cringe when I try to represent Plato, you know, that he really did think, you know, not everybody is made to be a thinker. He would probably look at our, for example, sending everybody to college as quite mad, and you know, and he might even look at what goes on in colleges and all the partying and wasting of parents' good money, and think, what are they, crazy? Why did not everybody has to be a thinker? Why is this being so valorized? So that unless you go, you know, to college and we're the point of it is to become a thinker of some sort. You know, unless you do that, you feel like you don't matter as much in the world. That's a wrong way of thinking about it. Now, here I'm just trying to channel Plato. I'm not endorsing these views. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to channel him. You know, wouldn't it be better if you know, if various aspects of society or various necessary jobs would be given as much respect, and that not everybody, you know, people wouldn't be pushed to feel that they have to be thinkers, since not everybody is made for thinkers, and that higher education of the sort that we get in university maybe should be reserved for those who are for whom it's going to be a joy. Plato is very, very much stresses that if the right education it varies among people, but it's always joyful. It always feels like play. If you want to be a thinker, then you're a person for whom ideas is play. That's playing, and that's not true for a lot of people. And it doesn't make you a better person if you're that kind of person.
But is this the real value of Plato? I mean, sort of helping us think about thinking. I mean, teaching us how to think well.
Yeah, I think, you know, that all of these questions come up everywhere. I think that's what I was trying. I'm I don't think. I know, but that's what I was trying to do by bringing Plato forward. I also wanted to make him often quite surprised at how well we're doing. People whom he might have disdained and then kept out of his own academy. He was, of course, the founder of the first European university, the academy. He did accept women, by the way. So women, he was fairly egalitarian when it came to the genders. But I did want him to be surprised by the progress that we've made, and some of us whom he may not have expected to make progress. But I wanted to demonstrate how the kinds of questions that he raised, or iterations of them that are continuous with the questions that he first raised, are all around us, so that when we ask questions like how should we raise our children, what kind of values, what kind of desire for their own life should we implant in them, should we want them to be successful, so that nothing else will do, so that they'll be extraordinarily successful people, or should we want them to be happy, or should we want them to be good? there's a quaint idea. Should we want them to just be really good people who will think about what they can give to others?
So how did Plato answer that question?
I think that he would say that above all else, the thing that is most important is to be good, to be virtuous, and to get a control over our own ego and to see our own little lives in perspective. As much as is possible, to expand our own little lives with a kind of participation. That's a very Platonic term, participation, with a kind of participation in things that are not ourselves, with the world at large, if we are so lucky as to be able to understand it, with others, with our society. But to merge the self with as much that isn't the self as is possible, that's virtue, and that's also mental health, and that's also happiness.
Now, there's another, I think it's a quote that has been handed down from Plato, who knows if it's really true or not, to philosophize is to prepare to die.
Yes, it's true. It's from the Phaedo.
Okay. What did he mean by that?
Now, I'll give a little context, because that dialogue, which was written long after Socrates died, is Plato's rendition of Socrates' death. And it's not a faithful rendition, because Plato uses all sorts of ideas, including the theory of forms, that Socrates himself didn't have, we're pretty sure. But Socrates is he's in his prison cell, he's having the last philosophical conversation of his life. Plato goes out of his way to tell us that he wasn't there, that he was ill and he wasn't there. And he's arguing very tentatively for perhaps the possibility of the souls surviving the death of the body. It's a pretty relevant topic when you're about to swallow hemlock. But it's very, very tentative, his conclusions there. In any case, one of the things he says it's very continuous with what I was just saying, that to philosophize is to fill one's mind with so much of what is not really personal, is doesn't really have to do with your own life, but to take in as much of the world as possible, that your own connection to yourself has somewhat weakened. The joys that you've taken have been the joys of existence itself, the wonder of existence itself. And you're able to take a kind of solace from the fact that existence exists, and you've been able to incorporate some of it into your mind, some portion of it into your mind, and therefore expand your life so it's more consonant, more congruent with existence itself. And so your own little personal contingent finite self has come to matter less and less. In that sense, to philosophize is to learn to die, is to prepare to die.
Because you are not placing so much value in your own self at that point? Not exactly sure what you mean.
Well, it's that the great joys of your life have come from the extent to which you've been able to participate in existence. Existence will go on without you. The existence that you took joy in will go on without you. And there's a, because that existence has given you joy, you will, and it's a beautiful existence. Plato's view of reality, and this is the thing that had really, I first came across Plato when I was a very young child, when I was 12, and I was reading The Story of Philosophy by Will and Ariel Durant. And I got really, really excited. And this was the part that really excited me, that Plato promised, or his vision was that beyond all the chaos and confusion and misery of contingent life, there is this structure of the beautiful, the good, and the true. And they're all intertwined with each other. In the book, I call this the sublime braid. And I think that this is, you know, very much the heart of the vision of Plato, that existence itself is structured by beauty, truth, and goodness. And to see that and to participate in that is to take such joy in existence that you are reconciled to the fact that it will all continue without you.
That is a wonderful place to leave it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.